Hello, folks. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Federalist Files. On today's show, the New York Times article about the Mueller probe, Biden's idea to classify terrorism as anyone that disagrees with the media, Fauci reveals his redacted email with Mark Zuckerberg, China shuts down a bunch of Bitcoin mines, and finally, the effects of fatherlessness in the home.
The administration has in place to make sure that the children of top officials don't get preferential treatment in hiring?
Sure. Well, let me say first that we have the highest ethical standards of any administration in history. A number of ethics officials have conveyed that, and we're proud of that. We have also staffed up at a...
Hello, everybody, and I appreciate you all tuning in. That is unbelievable. Joe Biden with his dealings over in Russia with Burisma, with his son, and China involved as well, all these people that he was meeting with, and this is somehow the highest standard for any administration to ever have in terms of ethics. I just think it's hilarious. Not a huge fan of Trump himself with his kids in there in government. Nepotism is never really a good thing, especially considering the government was kind of being ran by two people. Like his son-in-law and his daughter are kind of known as liberal Democrats. So I have a lot of good stories today. I have this New York Times story I've been holding up on. Well, it's actually a conservative treehouse story, and they quote the New York Times, and they show how the New York Times is now kind of backpedaling a little bit. They're covering up something that may release in the future, and it's about specifically the Mueller probe. And how there's all this information that was being they were attempting to get to Trump by going through Donald McGahn, who is the former president, as in President Trump's, I think his lawyer, White House counsel, okay? So it starts off this piece from the conservative treehouse. My headline is what happened. The New York Times headline is massive spin. This is their headline, and I quote, Apple is said to have turned over data on Trump's White House counsel in 2018, end quote. Notice what the New York Times is doing here. Everything about their article is written to hide, obfuscate, and ignore the reality of what their article actually is revealing. Now look closely. So I'm going to go into this article. I'm actually going to read it. It's directly from the New York Times, what I'm about to state here. And more importantly, there's really no reason given for Apple giving out this information. They make it like Apple gave the information, but the Justice Department subpoenaed it, so Apple kind of has to play along with that subpoena. But they make it like Apple's the wrongdoer here rather than the Justice Department being weaponized against Donald Trump and his team. And you got to remember, in 2018, he was the president. So what you had going on is you had a full-on investigation of Donald Trump through proxy, through his White House counsel, to literally try to find anything they could to gin up a further investigation on Donald Trump. So, from the article, straight from the New York Times, okay? Apple told Donald F. McGahn II, the White House counsel to former President Donald Trump, last month that the Justice Department had subpoenaed information about an account that belonged to him in February 2018, and that the government barred the company from telling him at the time, according to two people briefed on the matter. Mr. McGahn's wife received a similar notice from Apple, said one of the people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive matter. Okay, it is not clear what FBI agents were scrutinizing, nor whether Mr. McGahn was their specific focus. In investigations, agents sometimes compile a large list of phone numbers and email addresses that were in contact with a subject and seek to identify all those people by using subpoenas to communications companies for any account information like names, computer addresses, and credit card numbers associated with them. Still, the disclosure that agents secretly collected data of a sitting White House counsel is striking as it comes amid a political backlash to revelations about Trump-era seizures of data of reporters and Democrats in Congress for leak investigations. The president's top lawyer is also a chief point of contact between the White House and the Justice Department. So it's very weird. They really provide us no information for the reason for the subpoena. This is really what the problem is. In order to get a subpoena, you need to have a probable cause. You need to go to a magistrate. They called it, I think, a judicial magistrate, which is also known as a judge, in order to get this subpoena. Or you need to go to a judge to be able to subpoena. You need some sort of a warrant, or you need some sort of a probable cause to do so. You can't just walk up to Apple and say, you have to give us personal information of this individual, okay? So Apple told Mr. McGahn that it complied, and this is still from the New York Times. Apple told Mr. McGahn that it complied with the subpoena in a timely fashion, but declined to tell him what it provided the government. According to a person briefed on the matter, under Justice Department policy, gag orders for subpoenas may be renewed for up to a year at a time, suggesting that prosecutors went to court several times to prevent Apple from notifying the McGahns early. Apple told the McGahns that it received the subpoena on February 23, 2018, according to a person briefed on the matter. The other person familiar with the matter said the subpoena had been issued by a grand jury in Eastern District of Virginia. It is not clear why prosecutors obtained the subpoena, but several notable events were occurring around that time, okay? It's amazing to me. So they got this subpoena, and then they actually put a gag order on Apple. So Apple didn't know the information that they gave away, or rather the McGahns were not able to be notified by Apple of the information that was given away to the Justice Department. So it goes on in this piece, and this is what the writer at the Conservative Treehouse wrote. There's no actual author when I was looking for it. This is what they state next, and I quote, "What the special counsel was doing in February 2018 was, 1, covering the tracks of the Obama-era political surveillance, 2, trying to retain their own investigative credibility by hiding prior abuses by the DOJ and FBI during that surveillance, 3, continue surveillance of the Trump administration under the auspices of a Trump-Russia collusion conspiracy investigation, and 3, build a fraudulent obstruction case against President Trump in order to remove him from office." Yeah, so they were going after his White House counsel to try to really find anything they could on him. They couldn't obviously find anything. And this was the Weissman-Mueller special counsel. This is kind of like the Mueller probe, where they were going forward with trying to find any type of evidence, anything they can link to Donald Trump. And there was a gag order where no one even knew what kind of information Apple was giving out. Whatever it was probably emails between Trump and his legal counsel. And this is just amazing. So the New York Times is kind of running ahead of this story. That's what's said in this piece at the Conservative Treehouse, because there's going to be some sort of information that maybe comes out soon, and they need to cover themselves and say, hey, look, we covered this. But what they do is they use this title that suggests that it was not the Justice Department pursuing Trump. It was more like Apple just handing over the evidence. And that's just not the case. The case is the Justice Department was weaponized against Donald Trump. The Justice Department right now is being weaponized against people from January 6th. The Justice Department is being weaponized against conservatives all around the country. That is just the truth. Anyone that looks for freedom, that yearns for liberty in this country, they are being weaponized. They are having the FBI breathing down their neck. Anybody that is prominent, they're coming for you all, folks. If they're able to do this to Donald Trump, then they're able to do it to anyone else, okay? And this is going to get to this point where we may actually see this, and it's always people that you notice that run for office maybe they're going to go after, but we may actually see this in our lifetime. We may actually see within the next couple of years the government start to go against people that they consider political dissidents, people that are against communism, Marxism, and against this groupthink ideology, against the worldwide globalist government. People like a Candace Owens, they may go after. Ben Shapiro, Alex. I really wouldn't be surprised if they went after Alex Jones. They've been kind of going after Alex Jones with these petty, with a lot of this. They sue him for petty, whatever. Just going after him monetarily. So that's what we might see. We might see people. We might see the government attempt to defund these individuals. That might be the best way for them to go after them, or imprison them. At this point, we really actually legitimately do not know what the government's capable of. If we have another conservative get into the presidency, then we can definitely see the FBI try to figure out, like they did with Alex Jones, kick him off of all social media sites and try to block him out and suppress his content from the mainstream, from the people, because he had such a huge impact on the election. We're going to see that across the board. We're already seeing that shutdown attempted right now on YouTube. But we're going to see it in mass as we get closer to the election, the next election that's upcoming for sure. Okay, so the 2024 election, we're definitely going to see these exact same tactics that we saw right before the 2020, right after the 2020 election. I think they're going to be much stronger this time, much more robust, okay? So next what I have. I have this, and this is insane to me, okay? The Biden scheme right now, okay, so for his new strategy that they're trying to implement, I guess you would say, it's the national strategy for countering domestic terrorism. They mention Al-Qaeda only once in its 30-page document, okay? It's a front-page mag piece. It's written by Daniel Greenfield. This is a great piece of a great article. Okay, so even though the FBI continues to break up Islamic terrorist plots against America, the document only defines Muslims as victims. So mostly this document is going to go through white supremacy. It's going to go through white nationalist groups, domestic terrorism. And then more importantly and more troubling, it goes through anyone that disagrees with the narrative of the media or spreads and disseminates misinformation, as they call it, they are now to be classified as actual threats to the country, as domestic terrorists. And it says it directly in this national strategy, and I'm going to go through it here. So just last month, a Seattle Muslim convert was arrested. The convert had discussed driving a semi-truck through the Gay Pride Parade in downtown Seattle, even though the arrest came shortly before the anniversary of the ISIS massacre at the Pulse nightclub. Both Biden and the media ignored the potential plot, the fact that the Pulse shooting was Islamic terrorism. And this is how the Seattle convert or whatever, this person that converted to Islam, he stated, and I quote, "I wish to see the kafar," which are considered people that are non-Muslims, "so I'd like to see the non-Muslims as I kill them. I want to strike terror in them and make Allah pleased for doing so," end quote. So we really, this author goes through, Daniel Greenfield, goes through all of the most recent Islamic terrorist attacks in this country. There's been many. And he says this really was not a main strategy in this national strategy for countering domestic terrorism. And it's redefining terrorism in this 30-page piece, which is going to be used as an initiative for our federal law enforcement to classify terrorism. And really what it is, it's a mission statement. It's a method of operation of how we will enforce domestic terrorism from here on out, okay, in this administration. So it redefines the terrorist threat as coming first and foremost from political opponents of the Biden administration, and it defines that threat as a primarily political and ideological battle rather than a violent threat. The new strategy doesn't come up with any new ideas for fighting terrorism. Its ideas fall into the murky territory of preventing terror through everything from internet censorship to critical race theory. Biden is rebooting Obama's countering violent extremism program to target Americans in a battle of ideas against quote-unquote misinformation and quote-unquote racism. This also defines the administration's two approaches, indoctrination and suppression. So through this 30-page paper, what this is it's a Trojan horse to indoctrinate as well as suppress content and deem anyone that spreads misinformation as a racist, white supremacist, domestic terrorist, okay? So the strategies, concluding sentence speaks of, and I'm quoting, this is directly from the strategy here, finding ways to counter the influence and impact of dangerous conspiracy theories that can provide a gateway to terrorist violence. And additionally, it warns, and this is me directly quoting from the strategy, an information environment that challenges healthy democratic discourse. And also additionally cautions that directly from the piece I'm quoting here, And I quote, "Today's digital age requires an American population that can utilize essential aspects of internet-based communications platforms while avoiding vulnerability to harmful content deliberately disseminated by malicious actors online," end quote. So you notice how broad and how undefined these statements are that they're making. It's people that are challenging the healthy democratic discourse. What does that exactly mean? An information environment that challenges the healthy democratic discourse. So what, you're spreading information that you don't agree with a democratically elected person. You don't agree with the election process. Therefore, you are a domestic terrorist. That is what this is saying. That is the point of this. It is to scare tactic you into not speaking freely in the threat of being defined as somebody that is a domestic terrorist. And this is the really important part, the very first quote that I mentioned, finding ways to counter the influence and impact of dangerous conspiracy theories that can provide a gateway to terrorist violence. Okay, so you right-wingers, you conservatives that listen, liberals, I don't know if you even listen, conservatives though, have you ever put out information that somebody just called you a conspiracy theorist that is factually correct? Because I've been labeled a conspiracy theorist for stating an opinion or just stating an actual fact. I stated at one time that Dr. Fauci was a bureaucrat. By definition of bureaucrat, he is a bureaucrat. He's an unelected government official. I was called a conspiracy theorist for calling him a bureaucrat because I was inferring some sort of, because the person that calls you the conspiracy theorist doesn't even know what the definition of bureaucrat is because they're stupid and they're ignorant, okay? So the strategy, it blithely notes that, and I'm quoting directly from the strategy, and I quote, "The Department of Homeland Security and others are either currently funding and implementing or planning digital programming, including enhancing media literacy and critical thinking skills as a mechanism for strengthening user resilience to disinformation and misinformation online for domestic audiences," end quote. So the government wants to influence the discourse. The government wants to tell you what you have to think. They want to determine what disinformation and misinformation is and tell you this is how you should read the media. They're telling you specifically what you should think and how exactly you should think. They even mention in this piece digital programming. I mean, they're saying it outright, folks. This is blatant. They're blatantly stating, we believe in programming your children. We believe in programming people in a general sense. And this is what they've been going through. And he calls it propaganda in this piece, which actually I think that's a mild term for it. I just call it tyranny. I call it totalitarianism. This is like the Pravda over in Russia. They tell you what to think and they're telling you now how to think. Otherwise, if you think counter narrative, then you are a terrorist. You are labeled as a domestic extremist. So the broader priority is, and this is once again quoting from the piece, from the strategy, and I quote, "enhancing faith in government and addressing the extreme polarization fueled by a crisis of disinformation and misinformation," end quote, on the internet. The reason for this is now it's actually very clear and transparent to us that the government has been influencing private industries, some of these social media, big tech companies like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. They have been influencing these big tech companies to do their bidding in the government. They have now become an enforcement wing, and I knew this all along. I was calling this months ago that they are an enforcement wing of the Democrat Party and the establishment. That's what they are, and this blatantly states it in this piece. So the Biden administration will only acknowledge two terrorist threats. The first threat comes from, and I'm quoting from the piece, "anti-government extremists," end quote, which justifies a crackdown on any kind of political opposition and suppression of, and I'm quoting here, conspiracy theories, end quote. The second threat comes from racists, which creates an urgent need to tackle, and I'm quoting here, the threat posed by domestic terrorism, end quote, with, and quoting, substantial efforts to confront the racism that feeds into aspects of that threat, end quote. So what they're going to try to do is they're going to try to deem anybody as a domestic terrorist if you disagree, if you believe in some sort of conspiracy theories, or really if you are anti-government, anti-government extremists, what do you consider anti-government extremists? Because I can tell you some pretty extreme views that I have. I think that we should abolish the social security safety net system. I think in a general sense, federally, we should abolish most of our safety net systems. And we should be much more comprehensive. People would argue that that's anti-government extremism, okay? In the modern-day progressive era, that they're supposed to be so tolerant of viewpoints, they would deem me as an anti-government extremist. So now I'm considered, I am deemed a threat. I am a domestic terrorist to the government because I do not believe wholeheartedly in what it is that they're doing in the confiscation and redistribution of our wealth and the working class and the abundance of printing more and more our monetary policy is terrible, printing more and more of what they call our currency and diminishing the value of whatever you have in your bank account. I'm against all of that. So I am the anti-government extremist. It's anybody that doesn't believe in what the government is doing at that time, then you are considered an anti-government extremist, wouldn't you think? By definition. Okay, I'm anti what the government is currently doing. I mean, it is in the definition of the words and the way in which I lay out the sentence, okay? So it goes on. That means, and I'm quoting, means tackling racism in America with a civics education that covers, and I quote, when racism and bigotry have meant that the country fell short of living up to its founding principles, end quote. So this to me is very subjective. When they say founding principles, you realize how they don't define anything straight up. And they just say racism and bigotry. Once again, these are things that they do not define any of these things. People like to say, I know what racism is. Racism, definitionally, fundamentally, it is a belief that one race is fundamentally and inherently better than another and superior to another. Okay, that is what racism is. Bigotry is kind of very similar, but it's in the case of other groups, ways that people like to lump themselves together. Okay, so really this comes down to tackling racism. So if you're anti-government, then you're also most likely racist. And we need to tackle that. We need to stop anybody. Also, additionally, if you're a conspiracy theorist, then you're also a racist too. And we need to tackle that, and we need to stop the dissemination of their information, disinformation, and misinformation. So, but the strategy is also much more ambitious than that. And this is me directly quoting from the piece. Prioritizing efforts to ensure that every component of the government has a role to play in rooting out racism and advancing equity. So I don't know how this has anything to do with enforcing terrorism or enforcing law enforcement to mitigate terrorist activities in our country. I don't know how that has anything to do with it. Racism and advancing equity. And equity is a real problem. It used to be equality. Now they use the word equity, meaning if there's any type of disparity, it is automatically attributed that there is some sort of equity problem, as if, and this is this principle, this word of equity, it is a communist principle. If there's any type of disparity in how much money I make a year opposed to somebody else that may be of some sort of other racial or ethnic group, and we could have two totally different jobs, it doesn't matter. We need equity. They need to take money from me, confiscate it. They need to give it to them to match our salaries as the same. That is what equity is. So that is rooted deeply in Marxism ideology. It's everybody gets paid exactly the same for the execs, for all different jobs. And then that destroys the incentive base to the system. It is anti-capitalistic. It is anti-free market. It is anti-liberty, anti-freedom. You do not own your labor at that point. The government owns your labor, and other people actually own your labor that don't pay you. You pay other people, and in return, they do nothing for you. Okay, so the strategy document begins by redefining terrorism from an organized, even in the loosest sense, movement to, and I'm quoting here, lone actors who, and I quote, mobilize to violence with little or no clear organizational structure or direction, end quote. I think this is very interesting because usually terrorist groups would be multiple people. Yeah, there's the lone wolf terrorists, I guess, but the last one, there's the Pulse nightclub shooter. I'm trying to think. I mean, it's really just those people are the active shooters that I know of. Then there's obviously Timothy McVeigh, but that's more than 20 years ago at this point. The document skips over the vital question of whether they are part of any movement calling for terrorism Instead, it claims that their, and I'm quoting here, fluid ideologies connect and intersect with conspiracy theories and other forms of disinformation and misinformation, end quote. So what they're trying to deem is anybody that acts as a lone actor, a lone wolf-like character, it's because of disinformation and misinformation, and we need to stop that. We need to curtail that as best as we can. And in order to do so, we need to infiltrate these tech companies, and we need to control the discourse and the information that's allowed to be disseminated to the masses. And what we're really telling you all is you can only read what the government approves of you. That's simply it. And this is actually funny. This is like, it's so anti-freedom. It's just a squelching of liberty here in this case. And this isn't surprising to anybody. This has been going on now for months on end. And now the government has actually finally come out telling everybody and informing them. And this is very undermined. I actually did not hear about that. I heard about this briefly. I could not find it anywhere in the news. I was looking it up, this exact article. And somebody in a space on Twitter, in a Bitcoin space, actually informed me. And I said, yeah, man, I heard about that. I've been looking for that article. And he sent it to me in direct message. These people that believe in Bitcoin are like extremely, I would call them conservative libertarians for the most part. They don't believe in these big governments. The government controlling the means of production, the government controlling what you're allowed to think, what you're allowed to say, what you're allowed to read. They're just against that wholeheartedly, which is great to hear from them. If that's the future, if that ends up being the currency of the future, or the holding of value of the future, I think we're looking very good. Country, really worldwide, but we're looking very good in this country if those are the future leaders of tomorrow. So Zuckerberg's redacted email to Fauci. I have this piece from the National Pulse. It's written by Raheem Kassam and Natalie Winters. Or actually, you know what I'll do first? I have this clip from Maxine Waters. I just want to go over this. This is amazing. So in the middle of this, while we're talking about disinformation, they're talking about white supremacy, racism. Maxine Waters, she decides that she wants to go on CNN. And she wants to pretty much virtue signal on Juneteenth to say how bad the Republicans are, and they're the ones that helped plan themselves January 6th. Play clip 5.
That our democracy was undermined, and that cannot be tolerated by either side. And I want you to know, these are real domestic terriers. We're talking about the Proud Boys. We're talking about the Oath Keepers. We're talking about the KKK.
Some of these congressmen on the Republican side, as you know, Congresswoman Waters, are saying it was the FBI. Now they're saying it's the FBI.
They can say whatever they want to say. You know, one of the things we know is we need a commission. And they're opposing a commission to find out who all was involved. Where did the money come from to send busloads of people in? Who supported them in all of this? Where was the organizing taking place? I'm told there was organizing taking place right in the Trump campaign. And so,
they're never going to let this go. This is going to go on up until 2024. This is going to be used kind of how Trump used, or how they used Trump in Charlottesville when he condemned white supremacists and Nazis totally, and then they cut the clip and they mixed it around. They're going to do the same thing here in this case. They're insinuating that the KKK was involved. Last time I checked, I don't even know how serious the KKK is right now in this country. It doesn't look like, I didn't see anybody in white hoods running up to the building. I don't know. That's an unsubstantiated claim. She's making these claims, and then she's saying there's been no investigation. There has been an investigation. That's what I just went over last show, that revolver piece showing and signifying that the FBI was involved. So yes, there already has been an investigation, but they want to continue with investigations through the Senate now because they want to drag this thing out as much as they can for political gain. This is all political, folks. This is all optics. And at the very end, the Trump campaign, the Trump people themselves were involved with this. Like, I mean, this is, it's just false. How are you saying that? If you're claiming there's no investigation, and then additionally, then you claim Trump was involved in this. I thought there was no investigation, lady. How is it? And she stumbles over her words. I mean, she's got this ridiculous wig on. She's in her 80s. And she talks about, these, as she claims, the insurrection or political violence of any kind on both sides should be condemned. Meanwhile, all summer we saw BLM, we saw Antifa rioting, destroying cities. I think it's something like $200 billion worth of damage. You had 100 people, 100 something people badly injured. I think 12 people died during this entire event. It just doesn't, it's nonsensical. It's just nonsensical if you're going to compare the two with how bad it was all summer. Every big city was burning all summer, and that didn't matter politically. But it's all about political gain for them in the Democrat Party. It's all about grabbing power. It's all about politicizing things, calling the other side racist because all their ideas are terrible, and they know they're terrible, and they can't run on their ideas. So what they do is they go for personal attacks and impugning of character in an attempt to sway over voters that are just uninformed. So once again, I got this piece, Zuckerberg redacted email to Fauci. Fauci actually dropped the ball on this. He let I think it was, I can't remember what news program it was. He let them know, I think it was a podcast that he went on, what it was that was redacted. Who knows if this is true, but if it is, it definitely doesn't look good for Fauci. So this is what he states, and I quote, "I don't know who redacted that. When people ask for my emails, I don't look through my emails and say, okay, I'll give you this one and redact this. It's completely out of my control. So you want to know what the email was really about? Hey, big scoop. Here we go. Mark said, hey, is there anything we can do to help out to get the messages out? The right public health messages. I have a very important medium here in Facebook. Can I help? And as a matter of fact, if you guys don't have enough resources and money to do some of the things you want, just let us know." End quote. So it's very obvious, and I just mentioned this in the last segment of the show, big tech is working in lockstep with the government. He's saying, hey, just so you know, if you need any help, we're going to make sure the right information gets out. We're going to make sure that people don't disseminate other opposing views to what you say every single time you're on TV, whatever the CDC says as well. We will only provide the information that you want, Dr. Fauci. And then additionally, we'll give you some more resources and some more money. And if Fauci admits this, then yes, it's probably true, but that it could actually be worse. The wording could be much worse. We don't exactly know what was said and what. And it was redacted purely to defend Dr. Fauci and defend Facebook, obviously, to show that there's no antitrust going on, that the government isn't colluding with some of these big tech organizations when they really just are. This is just shameful stuff. Some of these big tech organizations, they're so strong, they're so big, and they're so powerful. And really, they have power that has never been seen before, that they can just brainwash an entire population the way in which they have done with all the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that we've seen over the last year with COVID, or the last year and a half now at this point. I live in New Jersey. I still see people walking around with masks inside, even though there's a lifted mandate, just because now it's a political symbol. It's a political icon to show, hey, I believe in the indoctrination that the government and the Democrat Party has been propagating for the last year and a half. Okay, so 60 Catholic Democrats, they wrote to the Catholic Church, at Catholic, quote-unquote, Breitbart news piece. So they wrote to the Catholic Church asking, hey, you guys can't take communion away from us. We still believe, because they believe in abortion. We still believe in abortion, but it's not right for you guys to take away communion from us. And they said, oh, you know, because of the Catholic religion, it wouldn't be right for you to do that, because then that shows that you go against the Bible. Whereas, yeah, so do you guys. You guys actually go against the Bible in a mortal sin way, which is way worse. But the U.S. bishops' faithful citizenship letter stated, and this faithful citizenship letter is a teaching document on the political responsibility of Catholics, underscores the evil of abortion, suggesting it is not, and I quote, just another issue, end quote, to be weighed against prudential matters such as immigration laws or a carbon tax, but stands out as a singularly weighty moral issue, which is so true. And the bishops declared in the letter, and I quote, the threat of abortion remains our preeminent priority because it directly attacks life itself, because it takes place within the sanctuary of the family, and because of the number of lives destroyed, end quote. So it's a strong statement. I know that some people hate Catholics because the Catholic Church has been so corrupt over the years. There's been some creepos in there. But this is a strong statement coming out. And they are 100% correct on the singularly weighty moral issue. There is people that are one-issue voters. They will vote, oh, are you pro-abortion? Yes, okay, we're not voting for you. There's people that legitimately vote that way. I know actually a lot of Christian, not Catholics in particular, but Baptist Christians, that literally this is the issue that they vote on. And we're talking about minority people that aren't voting for Barack Obama. They are black people that are not voting for Barack Obama specifically because he's pro-abortion. That one, they are one-issue voters because they believe in innocent life, and they believe it begins at conception, okay? And this is, if you actually look at how many people are aborted every year, I think it's around a million, I want to say, every single year in America. I want to say it's around 600 or 700,000. I don't exactly know. Maybe it's around 700,000 to a million. I'm not exactly sure of the numbers. But if you look at sheer numbers alone, that's one of the leading causes of death that is easily preventable. And that's why they believe in the sanctity of life. And just, I mean, this is always kind of, this has always made sense. This has always been straight by the Bible. And religion has kind of fallen by the wayside, and we've gotten away from it in this country. I'm not super religious myself, but I do not. I'm pro-life. I am extremely pro-life. Conception, pro-life. Across the board, pro-life. Okay. I don't think even in cases of rape, those are the very fringe cases. It's like 1% of all abortions. I am still pro-life because I don't think one wrong making another wrong makes a right. It just does not make sense to take out, because something wrong was done to you, for you to turn around and do something wrong to an innocent life that had no, that did not damage you in any way. So what I have next is I have Joe Biden. And this is a clip of him being asked, because Joe Biden, some bishops are saying that they're going to take away, that they will not serve him for communion if he goes up there to you know, get that little, the body of Christ and eat it. And then, you know, it's supposed to wipe you of your sin. He's no longer going to be eligible for that. I think they're kind of discussing that currently in the Catholic Church because Joe Biden is pro-abortion. Play clip six.
Catholic bishops have done. Are you concerned about this rift within the Catholic Church, and are you concerned about this action?
Say again?
The Catholic bishops are moving on this resolution that would prevent you and others who've supported abortion from receiving communion. Are you concerned about the rift in the Catholic Church, and how do you feel personally about that?
That's a private matter, and I don't think that's going to happen. Thank you.
Man, what a sleazeball. You don't even want to answer the media because they know this is a losing story. You can't definitively sit there and defend abortion. They just say, shout your abortion. They just go out there adamantly, vehemently. They support abortion, and it's difficult for them to actually get down to the meat and potatoes of what actually happens during abortion. You don't even want to hear. I mean, it's just disgusting, and they act as if it's a medical procedure, like you're getting, you know, a wart removed from your foot. But yeah, Biden's not going to answer that question. He was obviously, you could tell he was annoyed in his face. He's not answering that question. It's amazing, folks. So what I have next, I have a little bit of kind of economic stuff. Bitcoin drops to 2-week low. CNBC piece, it's written by Ryan Brown. Bitcoin fell as low as 31,760 Monday morning, dropping below 32,000 for the first time since June 8th. China's crackdown on cryptocurrency mining has extended to the southwestern province of Sichuan. According to reports, the People's Bank of China said Monday it had urged Alipay and some major banks to crack down on crypto trading. So Alipay is Alibaba, which is very similar to, it's really China's version of Amazon. Alibaba is the name of the company. They sell crappy Chinese products, and they sell them in bulk, crappy made like Chinese electronics. I've seen the site before. And I guess there's a form of payment called Alipay that you could use Bitcoin to purchase. They're cracking down on that. So a lot of these Bitcoin, the mining facilities are, many Bitcoin mines are in Sichuan, China. They were shuttered Sunday after authorities in the southwestern Chinese province ordered a halt to crypto mining, according to a report from the Communist Party-backed newspaper Global Times. More than 90% of China's Bitcoin mining capacity is estimated to be shut down, the paper said. China often does this. This is from Charles Hayter, CEO of crypto data firm Crypto Compare. He says, China often does this. When China sneezes, Bitcoin catches a cold. But this flexing of regulatory muscle is often just that in the past 8 years. This story has risen its head at least three different times. End quote. So yeah, they've done this multiple times. I think they're trying to create some sort of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, also known as FUD. I don't necessarily know the intentions of China in this case. I think that if they actually are doing this, they are crippling themselves in the future. I think that Bitcoin eventually will hold a huge stake of value, whether they take over the market for gold in value or they actually take over the entire market in its entirety. I think they definitely eventually will phase out gold, the gold standard, for sure. I don't know necessarily how much of the currency otherwise that it will take up. It could take up all of fiat in the entire world. I don't know how much of that there is. I want to say the number's like 90 trillion. If that is the case and that happens, we're looking at an increase. It's going to be crazy numbers, folks. It's going to be something, I want to say something like one Bitcoin would be worth $11 million, okay? So those are the actual chances. That's the potential of Bitcoin being a future hold of value. Currently, it is right now a hold of value. And this is the reason that Bitcoin dropped. What I think maybe China is getting involved. Maybe they're dropping the price purposely. They're coming out with all this fake news stories, and then they're buying it up themselves as a store of value. I find it very hard to believe that China doesn't want to store value. I understand that there are some repercussions for them because this would actually give their people some sort of independent financial freedom, which they fear themselves because they want the people reliant on them and the government. They want to spy on everything their people are doing. And because Bitcoin, in a way, the address for Bitcoin is anonymous. You have no idea who owns that address. Maybe that's really what they're worried about. They want to be able to spy on their people. But at the same time, they're falling by the wayside in this case if they screw this up. So I don't necessarily know what they're doing. I wouldn't be surprised if they were dropping the market so they can buy up Bitcoin very cheap themselves. And now they're going to hold it as a currency, as a value in their government, kind of like some countries used to do with gold. I don't know necessarily. I don't think China has gold. I don't think really anyone uses a reserve of gold anymore other than maybe Sweden and Norway. But I'm not 100% sure. So China's crackdown appears to have led to a significant decline in Bitcoin's hash rate or processing power, which has fallen sharply in the last month, according to data from blockchain.com. An estimated 65% of global Bitcoin mining is done in China. So I've only been really looking into this stuff for the last six months. From what I understand, I try to learn as much as I can about Bitcoin because, full disclosure, I am an investor. I have some money in Bitcoin myself. So I try to learn as much as I can. And from what I understand, these mining facilities, they mine the Bitcoin, the new Bitcoins that are then to be put into circulation, or the miner may hold the Bitcoin. If it's actually that valuable, they're getting their money back on mining. And it's naturally deflationary. So in the future, what it'll take double the processing power. And I think that happens every couple of years where we're actually having less and less Bitcoin going into circulation each year up until 2050. Which it'll be, I think, 21.8 million Bitcoin in circulation. Right now, it's around 18 million. So there's a very limited, finite source of Bitcoin, whereas with gold, you can drill into the earth and you can get more gold. So it is a finite resource, but we don't exactly know the calculation of how finite it is. We know how many Bitcoin there are, and that's it, okay? So these miners, they also have to do with hash rate, as in processing of transactions, buying and selling Bitcoin. It makes the blockchain slow if you have less of these miners with the hash rate or whatever, what have you. So that's another reason people are worried about the speed, which is additional FUD. But if you're using Bitcoin the way that it was made, really, you're just holding it. So it doesn't really matter how long the transaction takes as long as you're not sitting there waiting for a year. Generally, transactions on Bitcoin, I believe, generally take maybe 10, 15 minutes. They don't take that long to transfer the Bitcoin from one place to another. It's actually way better if you think about our current system. It's digital. Really, it's just banknotes being electronically moved from one place to another. That, for money to clear, if you want $20,000 to clear with your bank, usually it takes 1 or 2 days. With Bitcoin, if it's $20,000 worth of Bitcoin, that will take you 10 to 15 minutes. It's way faster. It's proof of work, they call it, as in you have it there. That's it. It's decentralized. There's different nodes. There's miners. The power is not held in one centralized entity. That is where, because at the time when we had gold, even there was a centralized entity, the government, that would hold the gold reserve, and they can kind of manipulate the currency. Whereas you have a decentralization of the currency in Bitcoin, it goes all over the place, and there's really not one primary holder that holds most of it and can influence the market that way, or like they could have done with gold years ago. I try to do my best to explain this. Anyone that has any questions, you can shoot me an email. I leave everything in the show notes. My Twitter, my email, Instagram, all that. If you want to follow me there, I can, or shoot me an email. I can direct you to sources that are much better than me. You can follow them on Twitter, and they hold these little conference calls or these spaces, and you can get in on those conversations and learn more yourself, which they are very informative. So the effects of fatherlessness. I have this piece from Brad Palumbo, and just kind of, you know, we had Father's Day over the weekend. I hope everyone enjoyed it. But there's those that do not have fathers in the home, or they had a father that was there but really wasn't there, or an abusive father. Brad Palumbo, in the very beginning of this piece, he goes through the story, his story, which is just, you know, it's just a terrible story. How his mother-in-law, or not mother-in-law, his stepmother was abusive, and his father was very apathetic, didn't really care. He also happens to be gay, which probably didn't help his case. Made it even worse in the eyes of his father, and the way in which he was treated. When he was 18 years old, he went through this story. He was 18 years old. His father dropped him off at his grandmother's house, so he hasn't seen his father in years now, and he still has yet to see. I want to say he said something like 8 or 9 years in the piece. It's just a very sad story. And he says he's lucky. he characterizes this story, his experience, as a lucky experience, because he actually, you know, he worked hard to get where he has to be, whereas with a lot of Americans, that's not the case. Some of them end up incarcerated. They end up dropping out of school, getting involved with the wrong people. So more than 25, and to start the piece, more than 25% of children in the United States, 20 million, grow up in a home without a father. Beyond that, untold millions more have fathers who are abusive, neglectful, inattentive, or otherwise inadequate. In all its forms, fatherlessness takes a serious toll on young people, particularly young men and boys, that can quite literally ruin their lives. So yes, usually this problem, it's way worse for young men and boys. Maybe it's because there's not that alpha in the household to keep you on the straight and narrow. There's no one to look up to. There's no one to follow on how you should act. Because young boys are much more aggressive, obviously, than young girls are. So as noted by the National Fatherhood Initiative, fatherlessness strongly corresponds to high and by the way, in the piece, this is all hyperlinked. You can find all this information. And that's why I leave everything in the show notes, in the description below. You can find all the sources that I reference in this entire podcast. So as noted before, the National Fatherhood Initiative, fatherlessness strongly corresponds to higher poverty rates, increased rates of teenage pregnancy, behavioral problems, abuse, and neglect. Children without fathers are much more likely to end up incarcerated, get addicted to drugs, commit suicide, or drop out of high school. So yes, this is all factually correct information. And this is actually our biggest epidemic that we really should be worried about, because we're molding the new young men in our society, and they're the ones to lead the country. They will be fighting in the wars. So this is a very important hot button issue, but it's really not covered. You're not going to see this covered on Fox News. Fox News isn't going to do this. Fox News is, you know, especially a guy like, unfortunately, Sean Hannity is very soft on stuff like this. He's not really going to talk about race relations in the way in which they have to be talked about. He's not going to talk about these kind of things where the biggest impact on some of these young men, whether they're minority or white population, it doesn't even matter, is their fathers. Whether or not they have a father in the home. If you look at some of these recent these mass shooters, a lot of them don't have any fathers in the home, a very high percentage of them. Okay, and that plays a huge role and an impact. So this deep hole in the soul of our culture is not easy to answer. One way we can begin healing is through initiatives such as fatherhood involvement programs, community-level programs in place across the country where stepfathers, neighbors, and other men in the community step up and provide father-like role models for fatherless kids. But the government has also caused fatherlessness and enshrined it as a perennial problem in our society through structural flaws in public policy. So yeah, the government's impacted this through different forms of their public policy, which has incentivized fatherlessness and single motherhood in the family structure. And additionally, I actually do like this idea, this fatherhood involvement program. This would be something that would work years ago. It used to work much better if you had, you know, fathers that were not in the home in the community. Some of the other fathers that were there kind of took the role as a role model. But that's because the society years ago was much more friendly. You were friendly. You talked to your neighbor. You talked to some of your community leaders. You talked to people in your community, whether it was you were going to the barber shop, you played childhood recreational activities such as sports. You talked to these fathers in the homes, whereas now it's just not like that. We're very displaced from each other. We do not talk. We don't conversate amongst each other or socialize like we used to. Everything's pretty much... we have a lot of tech things going on. We just do not socialize the same way that we used to, which is part of the problem. So it goes on. A generation of children has had to grow up without fathers because of the failures of our criminal justice system. We have locked up millions of men, disproportionately African-American men, over nonviolent and victimless crimes through the failed war on drugs, with no thought for the consequences this had on families and children left with no man in the home. So yeah, that's another thing. And then also additionally, the African-American leaders in these communities, especially for the crack epidemic, they pushed to have higher sentences on people that were got caught with possession with intent to sell because they no longer wanted it in the communities. I think that we actually have to look at the root cause of a lot of this stuff. I think the war on drugs obviously has failed. You have to take these people to some sort of, whether it's a rehabilitative program, we have to figure it out. But to lock people up, especially as users, I mean, it's different when you're a seller, I think, a distributor. There's a little different consequences that should be there. But when you're straight up a user of drugs, you shouldn't be sent to prison. It's just nonsensical. That's much more of a mental health issue than it is anything else. So there's another problem. He goes on to explain other problems, and these are really the biggest root causes, in my opinion. There's another problem with our legal system that contributes to fatherlessness as well. In family court divorce proceedings, courts are overwhelmingly biased in custodial decision-making in favor of mothers over fathers. Of course, in cases where truly only the mother is capable of providing a safe home, giving her primary or sole custody is entirely warranted. But it's sadly quite common for family courts to limit even a loving and capable father to seeing his children every other weekend, leaving those kids with a gaping hole in their day-to-day lives. This one resonates in a way, not to me personally, but I've had, you know how many stories I've been told by friends of mine that say, yeah, you know, this guy really cares about his kid, never sees him. Sees them Saturday, gets this many hours, on Sunday gets this many hours, that's it, you'll never see him for the rest of the week. And the mother really has like the sole custody. You just see your father every other weekend for a couple of hours, which is just a shame. There has to be a better system for this. The government is just deciding that the sole proprietor of the child should be the mother because they just believe in that, where maybe that is not the case and they should try to figure out some sort of joint custody agreement. And the real problem is the breakdown of the American family. We shouldn't really, obviously, we should not, we should try to mitigate and cut down on divorces in a general sense, but I mean that's just a whole other issue, a whole can of worms as well. So moreover, and this one's important, moreover, our welfare system has long encouraged, enabled, and exacerbated single motherhood because the benefit levels of various government programs skew higher when no male is present in the household. As Wall Street Journal columnist Jason Riley wrote of the welfare state, and I'm quoting, "The government paid mothers to keep fathers out of the home and paid them well," end quote. Yeah, so mothers were incentivized to not really stay with their husbands or stay with the father because they were getting paid by the government. So what's the point of having this man around to care for my child if the government will pay me whatever it is that he's working for? And it incentivizes a welfare state, a welfare system, also incentivizes not having a father in the home to care for your kids. I mean, there is a inherent role that the father plays as kind of the alpha in the house, in bringing up those children, especially young men. So this is a huge, I personally think this is one of our biggest problems in society. If you want to talk about the disparity in income, the black community, you want to talk about the disproportionate rate of crime in the black community and some of these minority communities, I think this is actually directly derived from this issue alone, is the single motherhood, fatherlessness crisis that plagues some of these minority communities, specifically the black community. And just listen to what Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo, what they're interested in while we're having this problem, and it's Father's Day. Play clip 8.
That history.
You know, I had somebody today say, well, you know, I'm worried. I want
in the telling of that history.
People lecturing my kid like, hey, you're white, you're bad because of this and this. I said, why do you think that's what it will be? Mm-hmm. I said, that's the only problem, is your perception. Why wouldn't want your kid to understand the roots of slavery and the legacy of slavery, how it has played out for enslaved people as a culture throughout the years? Why wouldn't you want that?
You don't think that telling people that they were beaten and sold and lynched makes them feel bad?
That's right.
Yeah, so, you know, CNN with the two of them, they're clowns. They make it like, this segment, they talked about critical race theory, and Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo made it like people are rejecting critical race theory because it teaches that slavery happened, and they're making it like that was never taught in school. Folks, slavery has been taught in school for a long time. It was taught when I went to school. Critical race theory, although, was not. Critical race theory teaches inherently that white people are responsible for slavery that happened eons ago, 150 years ago, when that's just clearly not the case. If you are part of a system where black people are not making, and there's any disparity, and this is why I call it cultural Marxism, if there's any disparity in any way of outcomes in a black person and a white person, then you are somehow complicit in this racist activity. It is taking the blame and is bestowing it upon everybody in a distributionist-like system, just like communism does with money. It is the same way with the wealth. It is just distributing all the blame to everybody. You're complicit in the system because you benefit in the system because you're successful and somebody isn't successful. That automatically means that it's attributable to some sort of racism in this system, rather than just maybe somebody worked harder than somebody else. This is a quality of outcome. It's not a quality of opportunity. And it is regressive in practice. It is communist. It is Marxist in practice. And that's really what they're going for in this case. So to get to a couple, I think I have my quick headline segment here. Yeah, I do. Okay. So Biden, he's going to be meeting with the Afghan president. Ghani is the president's name. The Afghanistan military has been sitting there fighting Al-Qaeda, from what I understand from this piece. It's an NDT piece. And they're going to go through how Biden's pulling the troops. We already see some of these terrorist organizations getting a little giddy already, fighting an uprising against the Afghanistan military. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I have Governor Murphy in New Jersey. This one hits home. He signs an executive order that bars landlords from asking tenants about criminal history. This is outrageous. It's ridiculous. If you're a landlord now, you don't have the right to actually ask people about their criminal history or do a criminal background check on them. You have to just give them the house, or then it's some sort of affirmative action, or it's some sort of it's against some sort of law, just some sort of discriminatory practice law, which is just ridiculous. I'm discriminatory because I don't want to give away my, I don't want tenants that are criminals. Really, is essentially what Murphy's saying. Murphy's forcing people to house criminals in their homes, landlords. So you got 23 shot Friday into Saturday in Chicago. This is sad. Lori Lightfoot's Chicago is a disaster. I've seen videos where I think it was, Chicago. They pulled two Puerto Ricans that were rocking the Puerto Rican flag on their car. If anybody knows Puerto Ricans, they generally are very, very prideful of Puerto Rico. They have Puerto Rican flag. Like Puerto Rican people keep Puerto Rican flags outside their house with their American flag as well. They're just very prideful of their culture, which is something that, I mean, it's great, right? For that, they got pulled out of their cars and both of them got shot dead. I've seen the video. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And that's what happens in Lawyer Lightfoot, Chicago. There's no action from the government. This will just continue to happen. These deaths, these shootings in Chicago, it is more deadly in Chicago than it is in some of the most deadly third world countries in the world. It's just humiliating. And it's pathetic because in the crossfire, kids get shot all the time. So Project Veritas, I have another reporter. I'm going to have a quick clip here. Another reporter is getting ready to come out against, and I think it's NBC or CNBC News, a local station. Check this out.
And speaking of a brand new week, I will be sitting down this week with Project Veritas to discuss the discrimination that CBS is enforcing upon its employees. Tune in to Project Veritas for my full story. Now, later Monday, we will see those showers continuing through late morning, but by evening, we'll see dry conditions and more comfortable temperatures.
So we're starting to see how bad the media is, that their own employees are even ratting on them here. This is a CBS 62 newswoman. I don't know what she said. There's been some racial discrimination in the workplace. I'm assuming she's probably been passed up on a lot of opportunities to move up within the company for her color, is what I would have to guess. So actually, I have another one, and this is Dana Bash kind of pushing the National Security Advisor, John Sullivan, about China, which is very surprising. Check this out.
Let's turn to China. We still don't know whether the coronavirus developed naturally or whether it came from a lab in Wuhan. China is stonewalling an investigation, and you said that we just can't take this line down. So what does that mean in practical terms? If China won't allow access, will the United States consider action against China to increase the pressure?
Well, first, Anna, there are two tracks that we're operating on in terms of trying to get to the bottom of how COVID-19 came into the world. One track is an intelligence community assessment that President Biden ordered. That has a 90-day clock on it, and in August, the intelligence community will report back. The second track is an international investigation led by the World Health Organization, for which President Biden has rallied Democratic partners to say there must be access to China to be able to get the data necessary to understand what happened here. We are not at this point going to issue threats or ultimatums. What we're going to do is continue to rally support in the international community. And if it turns out that China refuses to live up to its international obligations, we will have to consider our responses at that point, and we will do so in concert with allies and partners.
Does that sound like not taking it lying down? Sounds like giving them a lot of time.
And if there was ever like a look and a word and a voice for a smoozer, that's this John, what's his name, John Sullivan guy? I mean, he's ridiculous, this dude. Dana Bash, I'm very surprised. She pushes him on this, saying, yeah, you guys are going to give them 90 days in China. So what is that? You're not pushing anybody. We got together with our Democrat allies and some of our other world leaders, and we're going to push China. We're giving them 90 days. So you're giving them 90 days to determine how to fudge up a study, and then your intelligence is somehow going to be derived from what China tells you. So you just have to kind of trust China, I guess. I don't know. So yeah, that's it for this one, folks. Greatly appreciate everybody tuning in as always. Thought this one was a pretty good one. I don't know. A lot of good information, a lot of informative stuff. I was excited, you know, putting it together. And please like, share, subscribe, hit that Rumble button. You can reach me on YouTube. You can reach me on Rumble. I'm on almost every single podcast platform. I think Apple, Spotify, iHeart. What's the other one? The Amazon. I think it's like Amazon Audible or something like that. But I'm pretty much everywhere. You can find me on podcast. And yeah, share it with your friends. Drop the mic, as in my name, Mike. Drop the mic on people. Let them know about the podcast. Let them know it's a little bit different than what you're going to get with a mainstream, I guess you would call them, or a corporate media person. You're going to get some different info. You're going to get a different perspective from a working class U.S. citizen. So I greatly appreciate it, folks, and I will see you all next time. Thank you.